have a basketball program that we all expect to compete for Big Ten and national championships year in and year out.
There's no other way to look at it. It's one of the better jobs in the Big Ten.
Final four!
I didn't think you was going to be this good, but it feels good!
So, welcome everyone to the boardroom. We would like to welcome on a very special guest. It is Illinois' all-time leading scorer, former pro. He's the current Illini radio broadcaster. He just recently became the host of the Champagne on Ice podcast. And of course, just fighting Illini legend, the one and only Deion Thomas. So, Deion, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us here. Let's get right into it. Let's chat a little bit first about the current team. Obviously, some highs, some lows, roller coaster start in some ways. How do you think, all things considered, that the season has been going so far?
Well, first of all, gentlemen, thank you for having me in the boardroom. It is truly a pleasure. And thank you for throwing out my Champagne on Ice podcast. Hopefully I'll get to have you guys on there. Since you have me on yours, I got to get you on mine.
Yeah, it's a little home and home. That sounds fun.
Oh, no doubt. Come on, man. I'm used to home and homes, you know. That's what I did for most of my life. But this year's team, actually, I love this year's team. And, you know, you mentioned the ups and downs. Anytime you're bringing together so many new players, new faces, you're going to have ups and downs. And when you're also relying on two freshmen to step in the place of two seniors from last year, losing Kipper Nichols and, of course, Andres Feliz, you know, you're going to have those ups and downs. You're going to have those learning curves. And this is a team, last year's team, let's start with there, was learning how to win. Mm-hmm. You know, people look at what the Dukes do, the North Carolinas do, and all of the Blue Bloods, and they think that it's easy to win. It's not easy. It's hard. I mean, it is a culture that you have to build. I think Coach Underwood and his staff have done a tremendous job in a quick time of turning things around and getting this team to where it is today. This team has been exciting. Mm-hmm. But again, they're still learning. And that's the problem. That's the things you see in the loss against Baylor, which is a better team. But they had an opportunity to beat Baylor. Yeah. You know, there was 3 minutes in there where things kind of went off the rails. And what great teams do, which that Baylor team is make you pay for it. You know, then, of course, the losses in the Big Ten to Rutgers, to Maryland, those are games that you have to win. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's another learning part where this team has to pick up and has to learn. Mm-hmm. As you say, in their last outing, a big issue was starting slow. They came out, you know, I almost said balls to the wall. I guess I probably shouldn't say that.
No, it's okay. We have permission from our boss. We can say whatever. You can say whatever you want here.
There you go. And that's how they came out. I mean, they came out like gangbusters. It came out like they understood that they have a target on their back now, that they're that team that everyone's hunting. And when you're the hunted, you know, you have to come out and match that energy, if not, you know, surpass that energy. And that's what they did the last game. So, love the direction they're going in. Love what they're doing. Now it's about building that consistency and like I said, learning from past mistakes. And hopefully, after this last game, they understand that they got to come out fast.
Well, they certainly can use a fast start in their next game against Iowa, which is arguably the biggest, maybe most hyped up game of the season, you know, given what happened last year against Iowa and how good they are this year. What did Illinois do last year, I should say, that allowed them to beat Iowa? And what do they have to do this year to beat such a good Iowa team, especially after a long rest?
Yeah, and personally, let's start with that rest. I don't like that rest. And I know, you know, I coached for 8 years, and I think I can speak for Coach Underwood in saying that the greatest thing about rest is that you can get guys healthy that have nagging injuries like DeMonte was dealing with, you know. But for the most part, you don't like it because you get out of rhythm. Mm-hmm. And the rhythm is so important on the basketball court, which is what they did to Iowa last year. They took Iowa out of that rhythm. You know, Iowa is an offense that if you give them looks at the basket, you give them space, man, they can pile up points fast.
Yeah.
And last year, Illinois did a tremendous job defending them, especially their perimeter guys. Kind of what Indiana did to Iowa the other day. You shut down everybody else or you control everybody else because you're not going to stop Luka Garza. So you really want to control everyone else and make their jobs hard. Yeah. And in the game that they won, that's what they did. And that's what they're going to have to do this year, because this Iowa team is also a, you know, they can put up points, man. They can put up baskets,
yes,
and bunches.
Yes, they can. Yes, they can.
So you have to control them on the offensive end. But what Illinois has to do is be Illinois. When are they at their best? They're at their best when they're playing with pace. So they can't get in a half-court battle playing against Iowa, because Iowa's going to switch defenses from zone to man, from 2-3 zones to 1-3-1 zones to 3-2 zones now, since Illinois has so many shooters. They're going to try to mix things up. So Illinois has to play fast.
Yeah.
One, you do great on the defensive end. You limit them to one opportunity at the basket as many times as you can, so you can get out and run and transition. And when you can do that, we're great. Now, if we are in a half-court situation with Iowa, we're great when the ball is moving, you know, and they're not taking these 1, 2, or 3 useless dribbles and not going anywhere. So ball movement in the half court, of course, you got to make shots, and you got to make sure your horses are running. So you got to feed Kofi, make Kofi make Luka Garza defend, you know, because he doesn't have to play much defense on people. And you see what Indiana did to him with Trace. That's the same thing Illinois is going to have to do. You're going to have to feed Kofi. And then, Io's going to have to be Io, and the other guys have to make sure that they play their roles.
Right. What was your thoughts at the start of last game when Underwood changed Grandison with Demonte in the starting lineup?
Well, first of all, I love Jacob Grandison. I love what he brings to the team. He has an extremely high basketball IQ. You don't put the points up that he did before he transferred here and not come in to be able to score. So we know he can score the basketball. He shot almost 40% coming in as a transfer, so we know he can shoot the basketball. But his ability to pass the ball, as you saw in that last game, he made several high-low assists to Kofi, which were great, which we need. And then also he can defend multiple positions on the floor. And that's where I think that change came in the last game. Demonte, of course, is dealing with some injuries, a little bit on the hip, definitely his ankle. But you can't stretch Demonte out. He's still 6'3". And you bring in Grandison at 6'7", pushing 6'8" almost. Now he can defend a bigger four, which was one of the things we were having problems with, especially if you look at the Ohio State game, which we lost. You know, you bring in the bigger player now, and now he can create a little bit more difficulty from the defensive end, but he also can give you an offensive punch, and he's not going to make mistakes. So all you're doing is trading one Demonte for the next one. This one's just a little bit taller than the other one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. You mentioned Luka Garza, which of course you have to when you're talking about an Iowa basketball team. Let's say you're in your prime. How many are you putting up against him?
Oh, my gosh. Luka couldn't guard me, man. It didn't.
Good answer.
You know, Luka's, you know what the best thing about Luka is, and I don't want to take anything away from him, heck of a player, very skilled, can step out and shoot the basketball, one of the hardest workers in college basketball. Luka can't defend no one. I mean, so you guys are too young to have seen me play. So you can look at it. I shot a lot of free throws in my career. And all of that, a lot of that came from understanding positioning and understanding how to use and read screens. Because Coach Henson ran a great play for me, and they still run it today. It's basically a baseline-to-baseline screen where a guard screens the big guy. And if you could – they don't have video now. Damn, I feel old. But if you could pull out some of the videos of those things, it was – I never – if you look at the guys now, and Iowa runs it too. They set the screen for Luka. Luka runs straight to the post. I never ran straight to the post. I would step right around the screen, and I'm planted in the post with both feet in the middle of the paint, basically right under the basket. Mm-hmm. And so guys just – and they're trying to fight through, so now they run into you. Now, you know, man, I would have scored all day long. I might have had about 40. Easy.
I love it. Good answer. Good answer.
So when you're playing Luka, though, you also have to defend the perimeter. Would you be able to defend him out there?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. No, but seriously, on a serious note, that wouldn't have been a problem with me defending on the perimeter. I mean, I was able to do it in college. I did it, of course, my whole professional career when I went to Europe. You know, the way they play now is the way I played way back in, right. in 1994. So it basically would have fit right into today's basketball. I think I was born too soon.
All right. You and Chin Coleman coach together at UIC. Can you describe what Chin brings to the Illini staff from an assistant coach perspective?
You know what? That is the first question. That's the first time I've been asked that question. Great question, by the way. What Coach Chin brings, one, is a knowledge of the game. I mean, having played the game, he played at some of the best high school basketball over at South Shore. Then, of course, when he went on to Lamar, he was one of the better players there. Brings a high basketball IQ as a player, having played multiple positions as well. So with that, you can take that and translate it into teaching these kids multiple positions on the floor from a player standpoint. He brings a great energy to the floor, you know, always. He was a loud, you know, I'm not a loud guy. And when you would walk into a UIC practice, before you heard Coach McClain, you would hear Chin down there yelling. And if you walk into an Illinois game now, you hear Chin yelling. So his ability to be vocal and to get guys to buy in and relate to guys is tremendously important. And then, of course, we see what he's doing from the recruiting standpoint. You know, you don't get Io, you don't get Adam Miller and some of the others that you have on this team if it's not for Chin Coleman. So yeah. Coach brings a lot of positives to the team. And he really can relate to the players, which is something that's definitely necessary in today's basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. I love Chin Coleman. He's a loud guy
and great dresser too.
Yeah, really good fashion. I would say.
I agree 100%. He was always the best dresser on our staff too, so I'm not surprised.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. And you talked a little bit about Chicago. What do you think the keys are to recruiting Chicago as a former Chicago athlete and also just supporter of the Illini?
Well, let's talk about where the breakdown was. The breakdown was there was not an emphasis put on Chicago, and not to knock Bruce. I love Coach Weber and I love Coach Groves. Both of them are tremendous people. But there wasn't an emphasis put on recruiting Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's what Brad has done. And before when Brad took the job, that was one of the first things he said is, we're going back into Chicago and recruit. You guys are from the area, man. So Chicago basketball is something different. It's not like other places. You have to build relationships. You have to know people. You have to have those connections. And that's one of the great things that Chin Coleman brings, because he played in the CPS, coached in the CPS, coached travel basketball, you know, with the Mac Urban Fire. So he's in tune with everything that's going on in the city, and you have to be. But it's immensely important to keep those things going. And the most important thing is, shoot, you got to win. Mm. Those kids want to come to programs where you are winning, where they're going to be on CBS, ESPN, and whatever other channel that they put college basketball on, Fox, BTN. They want to be seen and be on television. And then they want to get to the tournament. This is what the last couple of years Illinois has done. And this is why Illinois has, as people say, returned to the stage and why they're sexy now. And this is why, you know, this is why I have to take my hat off to what Io DeSumo did.
Yes.
We were not at a point where someone as good as Io would say, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to go to Illinois. But this is a young man that is wise beyond his age. He knew he could have gone to basically any other program in the country and have been a great part of what they do. And what did he say? Nope, I want to start this thing back up. I want to kick this legacy off. I want to make my own mark. And that's what he's done. And then, you know, we get Adam Miller after that. And I think there will be other guys that follow after him. So you have to give him that love and respect and that foresight to be able to do it first and foremost, especially for a 17-year-old man, because these times are different than when I played. I mean, when I played, it was a state pride that you did, you know, that you would stay there. There wasn't the AAU basketball like you have now, where these kids are traveling from the time they're 12, 13, 14 years old. They're traveling all around the country, playing in all these different places. And so we didn't do that when I was playing. You played within your state. You were with your high school team all year, all summer, and you traveled around the state and you played. So it's a little different now. So to get those guys to stay home, I think you have to have all of that stuff, if not a combination of most. But winning is most important, and putting an emphasis on recruiting Chicago.
Yeah, we are very indebted to Io and the Dosunmu family for deciding to stay home. But let's talk a little bit about your Chicago high school career. How did that really develop you as a player, kind of night in, night out, going against future college basketball players and really kind of the hotbed of high school basketball being in Chicago?
Well, first and foremost, it made me the player that I was, because I played baseball before ever bouncing a basketball. I didn't bounce a basketball until basically I was a freshman at Illinois. And the way Bob Hambrick did things at Simeon, the way Bob Hambrick did things, his blueprint of developing and working with players, you can go back and look at the history of players that he put his hands on and see that it works. So when I got there as a freshman, he put me with a senior. Irvin Small was my senior. And that senior teaches you everything about the Simeon way. You know, basically how you go to class, you know, how you don't screw around, how you practice your footwork, how you practice your free throws, everything. So I learned everything from Irvin Small and from Bob Hambrick, which put me on the trajectory to do the things that I did at Simeon. Then, of course, I had great teammates around me that were all very, very good players in their own right, that went to various schools around the country and had their, you know, good careers for what they did. And that's what really helped propel me to play. But you talking about playing in the CPS, man, like you said, it was a murderer's row every night. I mean, that's almost like playing in the Big Ten. Yeah. You know, you get prepared. And I'm going to give you guys a little story.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I went to the McDonald's All-American game, and I was being interviewed, it was one of the first interviews, and the guy asked me, I can't remember the reporter asked me, he was like, well, so what do you think about the talent that has been assembled here for the McDonald's All-American? I say, man, I'm playing the Chicago Public League, bro. I go against stuff like this every day. Yeah. I was like, that was my litmus test to everybody that I played against. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't from, you know, at least a school as, you know, the Red South, Red West, Red North, then they didn't mark up. But, you know, Chicago basketball is some of the absolute basketball in the country, hands down.
Yeah.
This is why when you look at tournament teams, you look at Final Four teams, they always have 2-3 guys that are from Chicago. This is why every Division I high major college comes to Chicago to recruit, because you're going to get toughness. You're going to get, you know, basketball savvy and knowing how to play the game to match the skill level and just the things you grow up with in the inner city in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, basketball is easy after that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what battles come to mind with players in Chicago? To me, I know I've read some about Juwan Howard and you guys playing against each other, and you were someone that he kind of looked up to. Are there any other players from the CPS that you really vividly remember going up against and seeing them both in high school and in college?
Well, I mean, you would have to take Kenny Williams, who went on to Purdue. He was at South Shore before that. You have to go to Derek Thomas, who was at Robeson when you know, I was coming on as a youngster then. I was a sophomore playing against him his senior year. You know, right across the bridge, you know, I mean, we would play Glenn Robinson them every year in various tournaments. So I know he was in Gary, but he might as well have been in Chicago because we were always playing them. And not to mention those King teams with Marcus Liberty, of course, and Jamie Brandon. I mean, there's just so many. I mean, you can go to any part of the city. And then not to mention – not just the games that we played in the city, I mean, the pro-am games that we played against, that we were playing. I mean, you're playing against pros in the summer. So playing against Michael, playing against Scotty, Tim Hardaway, you know, and all of these guys. And, getting your butt kicked. But that's what made you a better player. I mean, my first time stepping on a basketball court, I was out there playing against Al Frederick Hughes. Now, Frederick Hughes led the nation in scoring when he was at Loyola at that time. I mean, and here I am. I'm an eighth grader out here getting scorched by these guys. And, You know, and we talk about how good Marcus is, but we never talk about how good his brother Daryl was. His brother Stretch. I mean, he was amazing. Hey, man, he's probably better. Marcus will tell you Stretch was better than he was. Right. And Marcus was the number one player in the country.
Yeah.
So just imagine, Stretch was on the court the first time I played basketball as an eighth grader. You know, because my brother played. So we're out there, and I'm like getting killed by these dudes. But that's what Chicago basketball is about. You get your butt kicked, and it makes you better.
Yeah, clearly made you into the player that you would go on to be.
Yeah, iron sharpens iron.
Exactly.
And also just the Simeon kind of fraternity and brotherhood. What was that relationship like with, say, like a Nick Anderson? Or did you know Benji Wilson at all?
I did not know Benji. I was in eighth grade when he got killed. So that was kind of the catalyst of my older brother kind of making me go to Simeon. I didn't know, kind of. He told my mom Deion needs to go to Simeon and play basketball. So I had not had the opportunity to meet Benji, but going in as a freshman, of course, with Nick Anderson, Irvin Small, Deion Butler, and just all of the really good players that were there. And I mean, even today, I mean, if you went to Simeon, you connect. It's almost like you being an alum of the University of Illinois, how we all connect. We're all family. You go somewhere and you hear an ILL, what's the first thing you say? I, and it comes all the way. It's the same thing at Simeon. I mean, through the generations, you know, we all connect, we all stay together, and we all, you know, we just continue to talk and work together.
Yeah, we remember there's been quite a few recent Simeon grads. So we had Kendrick, we had Jalen Tate. So hopefully we get some more in the future.
Keep that pipeline going. Yeah, absolutely.
And also just like you talked a little bit about the McDonald's All-American game. What was that like playing against Shaq? And could you tell right then that this guy's just a monster?
Well, thank God he was on my team and I didn't have to play against him. But yes, it was amazing. I mean, that's one of those once in a lifetime things. I mean, people can go their whole career and not play in something like that. So to be named a McDonald's All-American and Parade All-American at that time was amazing. And as I got older, I really began to recognize how important that was. But you asked the second question, if I could recognize Shaq was what he was. Yeah, real fast. give you another story. So we're in practice. It was our first or second practice. And you have this young Shaq that's a lot bigger than me. I mean, I went into Illinois at like 185 pounds. So I'm skinny, soaking wet. So we're standing on the baseline one day, and he looks down at me, and he's like, "Big bro." He's like, "I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do." I'm like, "Okay." So what we were doing was we're running this drill. You throw the ball off the backboard, you would catch it, pass it out to one of the guards, and then you'd run the floor like a transition drill. And then when you would come back, you would be met by defense. So you'd have to play defense one-on-one in the post or something like that. He was like, "I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, big bro. I'm going to throw it off the backboard. I'm going to go down to the other end and dunk it. Then I'm going to come back. I'm going to get the ball in the post. I'm going to elbow Matt Winstrom. I'm going to knock him to the floor. I'm going to dunk it and make the ball hit him in the face." I'm like, "Yeah, right." "Okay, dude. Okay." Literally, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And to add the cherry on top, when he elbowed Matt and knocked him to the floor, he dunked it. Ball hit Matt in the face, busted his nose. And Matt had to leave practice for the rest of the day. Now, you guys may not know who Matt Winstrom is. Matt Winstrom was the number one player in Texas. Now, Shaq was number two. I don't know how they screwed that up.
Yeah, for real.
Seeing he was the number one player in the nation.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're number two in Texas. Right. But, you know, he was with it. So he knocked Matt down. And Matt was 7'1". Big old body, ended up going to play at North Carolina. So he wasn't no slouch.
Right.
I called my brother after practice when we got back to the hotel. I said, "Bro," I said, "make sure you remember the name Shaquille O'Neal." That dude's the truth.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he hasn't changed personality wise much in the last 30 years.
Not one bit. I mean, I remember bumping into him, seeing him down, and we used to live in Miami, as you see, I got the 305 number. And so he was with the Heat at this time, and I'm out with my wife. And all of a sudden, this big, you know, I'm a big guy. But then I just feel this big menacing person just come and like grab me from behind. And I'm like, whoa. And I turn around and it's him. And wow. he has Dwayne with him. And I've known Dwayne since he was a little kid. His uncle and I played together at Simeon. So I've known him since Dwayne, you should have seen this boy. He was a beast when he was playing. Dwayne looked at him and said, man, I know Deion. I've been knowing Deion since I was 8. So we go through this whole thing, man. But no, he has not changed. Thank God. One of the best people I've ever met in my life.
So you, obviously you mentioned Shaq was a great recruit. He was considering Illinois. We had Tyler Cottingham on and he told us about his recruiting story. Did you give him any grief for not coming to Illinois instead of LSU?
No, that's why we just kicked their butt.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I'll show you why you should have been here. But I'll tell you this. I wish he had come. I mean, could you imagine me and Shaq on the floor together? Oh, my God.
Wow.
Man, we might have that championship sitting in there and the big fella played together.
Yeah.
Definitely nice to dream about. So, speaking of Illinois, moving on to your time there, I'm curious about your relationship with Coach Henson and also what it was like playing for him. I know you've talked about the impact he's had on your life and your family. What was it like playing for him and then after as an alumni?
Let me preface that by saying this. Basketball was so different back then. Back then, the head coach really sat above everyone else, and so your relationship was with the assistant coaches. When you had to go to the head coach's office, you knew you screwed up. Mm. Someone, right, you know, because they wasn't bringing you in there to pat you on the back or anything like that. So our relationship really got better once I graduated from Illinois. But during my time there, coach was great. He was always fair. And yes, he ruled me. I had to run the stairs and, well, the Assembly Hall, now the State Farm Center, on multiple occasions for things that I didn't do right in practice or something like that. So coach was great. But the great thing about him and the best thing I believe about him was when you made a mistake or when you were punished, you were never belittled. And there was always an explanation of why you had to do something or why you didn't do it right or wrong. And then he would explain to you what his expectations were from you. So I can always say that for my part, it was fair. I didn't like all the punishments and things that I had to do, but you know, they were fair once you sat back and sure. You looked at it. And from a basketball standpoint, you know, and I don't think coach gets enough respect for how good of a coach he is. I know that he's up for being nominated to the Naismith Hall of Fame this year. They'd be crazy not to let him in. Yeah. He's one of the, you don't become the all-time leading scorer at two different universities if you're not a great coach. It just doesn't happen. I'm sorry. And even when at our lowest point, I mean, we had walk-on starting at one point. We never got blew out of a game. We were always in contention. We were always in the top, you know, the upper half of the Big Ten, which was still, which is probably better then than it is now.
Wow.
I mean, you got to think about it. You got the Fab Five. Every team had pros on it. Yeah. Every single team. There was not a team that didn't have pros on it. But we never got blew out of a game. We were always prepared. I mean, shoot, there were times when teams would come down to run their plays. We call out their plays, and we'd start calling out their plays because we knew it. We knew everything that they were going to do, and there were very solid game-time calls that coach would make. Now, he did forget I was on the bench one time, but, you know,
Did you remind him that you were on the bench, or did you make that known to him?
Oh, no. I mean, no. You didn't say nothing to the coach back then. Nowadays, you can get up and say things to the coach. Ben, I'm sitting there on the bench, and he's walking up and down, and he stops in front of me. He said, hey, Deion, what are you doing here? I said, coach, you took me out. I was like, well, that's what I'm doing here. He was like, well, get up and get back in the game. So from that point on, he told me, he was like, if you're sitting over here, because as a coach, and I have to say this as myself, because I've done that and forgot one of my players was on the bench, you're trying to focus on so much that's going on in the game that, you know, you rely on your assistant coaches to pull your coattails and say, hey, you know Deion's sitting over here on the bench. Right. But, you know, they didn't do that. He told me, he was like, when you see things going bad, if you over here, you get up and you go in the game. Okay.
I love it. He's so honest with you.
And that was one of the great things about Lou Henson. And then afterwards, and I'm sorry to cut you off, and then afterwards, he was one of the first, when I decided to go into coaching, coach, of course, was one of the first people I called. I called him and I called my high school coach because I knew I would get the information that I needed to be successful from them. And his first thing he told me, he was like, Deion, he was like, make sure your players are tough. He was like, because you can teach everything else. He's like, you cannot teach toughness. I said, all right, coach. So, of course, all of my players were tough. And I never did. That was one of those rules that I did not ever I never went away from that. That was always the first thing I looked at. I always recruited players that played two sports. Hopefully it was a football player and a basketball player because I wanted somebody that had been used to getting hit and hitting someone because, you know, some people don't like to get hit.
That would be me and probably all of us who have never played a contact sport before. I would probably not be a good player in your system.
Yeah, well, we might not be the most smart, tough, dependable players.
Right, but. Yeah. But that's besides the point. That's why we chose this side of it, to talk
smart
about the
man.
People who are good
man.
At it. Yes.
Yeah, a little safer behind the mics. But yeah, obviously Coach Henson, a legend, led us to the Final Four in 1989. What was it like for you as a freshman then coming into that season after, given the height we were at the season before and having one of the most prolific years in our program's history?
Well, you know, if you remember that my freshman year, I couldn't play due to the whole investigation with Bruce Pearl. But I'll tell you this, not being able to play with that team, and I was really, really looking forward to it because I wholeheartedly felt that we would be back in the Final Four, if not winning a championship. Mm-hmm. When Lowell Hamilton graduated that next year, they were missing someone on the inside. And I thought I could have fit that extremely well. But watching that Flying Illini team was, you know, a huge reason why I went to Illinois in the first place. Mm-hmm. I loved what Coach was doing. You know, now they call it positionless basketball. That was just Lou Henson basketball back then. And we were one of the first teams in the country to have a 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", center so everybody could be interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And I just saw myself fitting perfectly into what they were doing. So I was crushed, one, to not be able to be out there with those guys and to play. But at the same time, I loved watching them play, and I loved being around them. It was just a bunch of great guys.
Definitely, yeah. No, definitely a big time for the Big Ten. A few big programs at that time, you'd mentioned the Fab Five was one of them. I'm sure people don't need reminding that they actually won that Final Four in 1989 and had beat us on the way. What was it like playing against them? Did it feel personal for you being at another huge program at the time in the Big Ten, or was it sort of cool to see that evolution and that sort of new style?
Every game was personal to me.
There we go. I love it. Yes.
No, my wife to this day, when I'm watching basketball, especially when I'm watching Illinois, when I'm watching basketball, she tells me, well, you need to learn how to just relax and enjoy the game. Nah, man.
We're all with you on that one.
Yeah, I'm a competitor. So every practice was personal to me. Every game was personal to me. I was never your friend during a game. I may have talked to you before or afterwards. And if you beat me, I probably didn't talk to you afterwards because that's how I was raised. That's the Simeon way. I mean, and that carried over to Illinois. I mean, like my high school coach, you know, you see guys today, they'll help guys up off the floor. My coach was like, don't you ever pick nobody. I mean, and I'm talking about this is us in practice now. This is us in practice. We're going against our teammates. And he'd be like, don't you pick him up. Let him get up on his own. So that's how that was my mentality from the time I started playing the game. So was it personal? Oh, every game was personal. And I love Juwan. Juwan is still one of my best friends to this day. But I was trying to kill him. Yes. I was trying to kill Chris and you know, Kenny Williams today is one of my best friends that was at Purdue. I was trying to kill those guys. I wasn't cutting them no slack. So every game was personal, whether it was American University or if it was Michigan.
Yeah, I think I can see why you're the all-time leading scorer in program history.
When other Big Ten teams are in the NCAA tournament, are you rooting against them like we are, or are you one of those Big Ten homers? Like, let's go Big Ten.
Oh no, I'm a Big Ten homer.
Oh, okay,
I'm a Big Ten homer, unlike
us. So you've matured a little bit.
Yes, I have matured. I'm a Big Ten homer, unless you're playing Illinois, and that's why, you know, when we beat Michigan last year at Ann Arbor, before the game, I went to Juwan and I gave him a huge hug and I told him I can't wish you the best of luck this game, but I wish you the best of luck for the rest of the season. But when they're not playing us, so we're not playing, I cheer for the Big Ten. And why? Because it's good for the Big Ten.
Yeah.
You know, this is the best conference in basketball. I want us to be able to go out and smash all of those people that be hanging on to the North Carolinas and the Dukes and all this other stuff, talking about the ACC or the Big 12 or the SEC or the best. Man, get out of Dodge. when they're not playing the orange and blue, I cheer for other guys.
That's fair, especially seeing like your good friend coach that team. I would imagine it's hard to not at least feel a little bit of an affinity towards him.
True
pride in that.
Definitely, yeah, very definitely true. Understandable. So,
and I also cheer for Chicago guys. So if there's guys on the other roster from Chicago, you know, I cheer for them. And this is, as much as this pains me, and it does, Konzo Martin is one of my best friends. You know, Xavier Pinson played at Simeon. Mm. So I cheer for those guys, except for when they're playing us. You know, like the other day, Pinson had 30 points against, and they beat Tennessee. I'm yelling at the TV for Konzo and for Pinson.
Right.
You know, like I wear purple and gold. I mean, and that will never, ever happen.
Right.
I didn't even want my kid to go there.
Hey, we appreciate and respect the level of, you know, Illinois loyalty. You know, I mean, we would never dare root for Mizzou ever. But I can understand the circumstances in which you would be like, hey, you want to.
Well, I didn't say I'd cheer for Mizzou.
Right. The specific important people. Oh, yes, that is a fair clarification. Yes.
Yeah, and Pinson you can't hate on as much. It's not like he was one of those Illinois offer guys who was either committed here or played here. Like, he seems like a good guy.
Oh, yeah, I don't cheer for those other guys.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay,
that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Will anyone ever beat your scoring record?
Oh, man, I wish they would.
Just so people will stop asking you about it?
Yeah, sorry if you get that all the time.
No, really, because the greatest thing that happened when I broke that record is I had Eddie Johnson call me. Eddie called me that night and congratulated me. And I can't tell you how I felt to have Eddie Johnson do that. I would love to be able to do that for another player that breaks my record. But in today's basketball and the way things are from the business side, I don't know if it'll happen in my lifetime. And I got to be straight up about that, because if you have one or two good years, man, you're out.
Yeah.
There's, you know, because it's not the same as when I was playing. And even then, I mean, I had an opportunity to leave my junior year. I had all these people call and tell me, yeah, you're a guaranteed first rounder, you're this. I told my grandmother, I'm like, yeah, granny, you know, they're saying that I can go in the NBA now and this and this. And the first thing she asked me, she says, well, will you have your college degree by then? And I was like, no, I'm going to have to go back. She says, then you're not going. That doesn't, and I mean, and we were poor as crap living on the west side of Chicago. I mean, when it would rain, we had to put pots in my house because the water was coming through the ceiling. Wow. I don't think parents are that gung-ho like my grandmother was then, you know. And I'll tell you this, and I'm going to be honest. If I had my son who had an opportunity, well, I don't have a son, but so I couldn't do it with my daughter. But if I had a son that was a guaranteed lottery pick or – man, I tell them to go too. I mean, because you run too many risks of being injured or this or that when you have an opportunity to set yourself up for life.
And I think that's why we all have so much respect for a guy like Io, who I don't know if he was necessarily going to be a lottery pick, but he was definitely going to go in the draft. And for him to say, I'm coming back one more year, knowing how much is on the line with, God forbid, injuries or, you know, falling in terms of prospect rankings, like, there is a risk. And I think that's why Illinois fans love him so much, is because he's putting himself out there just for Illinois.
No, and you're right. I mean, this is a young man that is wise beyond his age. And I mean, and he has a great group around him. His parents are amazing. His family is amazing. And they give him a lot of really, really good advice. And for him to come back, you're right. Now, if there's no COVID, does he come back? Probably not.
Right.
Probably not, because now you have the ability to get out in front of people, work out in front of people. I mean, most of the scouts had him as a second round draft pick last year. But I think if he would have been able to work out for people and they would have been able to meet him and talk to him, that puts him in the first round. Probably. Because it's so different watching him play on television or on video and then watching him in person.
Yeah.
I mean, you see his speed, you see his athleticism, you see his explosiveness, you know, and the great thing about the NBA is they'll teach you how to shoot the ball better. So, you know, all of those things were in his favor, but you still have to make the decision to come back. And for him to make that decision, which was very big, and it took some money out of his pocket, but I think it was the right decision. I felt it was the right decision for him to come back anyway. Pandemic or no pandemic, I thought he needed one more year to do exactly what he's doing now. I mean, the kid's shooting almost 50% from three. He's added another 10 pounds to his body.
Yeah.
And he makes the game look simple, regardless of who's defending him. You know, he just makes it look easy. You almost have to put your whole team on the defensive end to stop him.
Yeah.
So I think he's definitely raised his stock, and like you, I take my hat off to him for making that tough decision.
Yeah, it's not an easy choice.
Yeah, and as much as we love having him in Illinois, I think it would also be great to see him excel professionally, knowing we haven't had a guy drafted to the NBA in a few years at least.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Speaking of professional basketball, I want to talk about your pro career after Illinois for a second. So you were all-time leading scorer, like we talked about Illinois, big man on campus, kid from Chicago. Then you find yourself in Spain and Manresa, then Girona in your first few years. And people got to remember, there's no cell phones back then. You got to deal with the time change. I'm sure that'd be really tough for a lot of guys. What was that experience like, though, for you? Was it a huge adjustment, or were you just really excited to be able to continue your basketball career?
Well, first of all, when I got drafted, went to camp, had great camps down with the Mavericks. But when the opportunity came up to go to Manresa, the money was a little bit better. But for me, it was really the opportunity to see something different, to be able, because the NBA is not going anywhere, you know, and I wasn't going to all of a sudden in one year become a bad basketball player. So I was like, you know what? This is a great opportunity to go and do this, you know, to see something different, to play, to continue to work on my game and grow as a player. So when I got there my first year, I was rookie of the year there, which is a little bit different now. They just actually just put it on paper. They don't say, well, hey, you get a trophy for it and all this other stuff. They go, well, yeah, you did this. So I was rookie of the year there. I made the all-star team there, which again, and that's another thing. I'm not an all-star player. As you say, I take these personally. My wife used to laugh at me. She used to be like, dude, you need to just not play in these games. And so, but to go there that first year, my intentions, and I was actually planning on coming back after that season. This was supposed to be a 1 year thing for me, just to go and see and travel and have some fun. And I was going to do backpacking while getting paid for it to play basketball. Well, I get to go around Europe and play basketball games and just enjoy life. But in 1995, the NBA went on strike. And when they went on strike, that's why I went back the next year. And then I actually ended up meeting my wife. And I fell in love with Europe. I fell in love with being in Spain. So the The glare and the shine and the gleam of being in the NBA just wasn't that important to me. It wasn't that important in the first place. Let me say that. My whole thing of playing basketball, going to the pros, was to earn enough money to pay for law school. I wanted to be a lawyer, bro, or I wanted to be a judge, is what I wanted to be. And so it was to go back, you know, make enough money, play a few years, go to law school so I don't have debt. And that was supposed to be what happened. But I ended up getting over there. I fell in love with it, fell in love with the life, met my wife, and then her family's from Israel. So we wanted to make sure that we were close enough that her family could come see me, and then my family could come and see some things that they had never really seen before, you know, with the travel and those types of things. And we were able to do that. So that's really why I ended up staying over there as long as I did. But, you know, I loved it. And I look back on it, man, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah, so we were actually going to ask you, because we know that you played in Israel towards the end of your professional career, how you ended up getting over there. It sounds like, you know, you met your wife and then you wanted to play there so you could be, you know, around her. We actually talked to Malcolm a few weeks ago about his time, you know, playing in Israel right now. First of all, did you give him any advice about playing in Israel? And also, what is it like playing over there in Israel? He told us that it was a pretty basketball crazy country. Do you have any fond memories of playing? You played on a couple teams there in Israel, I believe.
Well, I played on several. Played for Maccabi Tel Aviv, which is the team in Israel, and I'll say the team in Europe. We won back-to-back European EuroLeague championships. Also played for Givat Shmuel, which is more of a medium-ranked team, as well as Maccabi Rishon. And I finished my career with Maccabi Haifa. Mm-hmm. So I played several teams. I love Israel. Love it to death. I am probably the biggest pro-Israel guy, you know, that went to play there. But you asked if I had spoken with Malcolm. I did. And we talked about it. And one of the things I told Malcolm was to really stay focused, because it's really easy to lose focus in Israel because, you know, everyone speaks English. You know, it's a very westernized environment. All the movies are in English. TV is in English. They party like no other, you know. The women are beautiful. I tell them per capita, they have the most beautiful women in the world. You know, so there's a lot of distractions that could take place there. And then it's small enough that all of the Americans can get together and play out. So I told him, make sure he maintains his focus and stay focused and really just concentrate on what's important and play basketball. But one of the other things I thought was really important is networking. Make sure you meet and talk to every single person that you can there. Tal Brody is the man over there.
Yeah.
So make sure that he connects with Tal and that, you know, you continue to work that relationship and the relationships that you have over there. Because they're not just there. They're the same relationships that are here. You know, we do a lot of things with the JNF. I want him to be able to come back and do some things with the JNF and the JUF. Now, of course, I'm a citizen, so my feeling is a little different probably than what his will be. But, you know, we've had multiple U of I players go there and have really great times while they were there. So he's another ambassador for us. And knowing Malcolm, you guys have talked to him. He's a great young man. So I know he's carrying the torch well over there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you have any good Brian Barnhart stories that you'd like to tell us? Because he likes to talk.
He does like to talk. But, you know, Brian's amazing, man. I mean, Brian is the consummate pro. And, you know, watching, you know, I picked up a lot. I was on BTN before I joined the Illini Network. And TV and radio are two totally different things. So sitting there on the radio with Brian, which Brian has to paint a picture for the listener of what's taking place on the basketball court. And to watch him do that, to see how he comes in and he's prepared and the notes that he has and how he does not screw up difficult names. You know, I started calling Georgie Bajanisvili, Georgie B, because I could not pronounce Bajanisvili. And he sat there with me and walked me through how to say Georgie's name. But, you know, some of the other players that came through there, I think it was who were we playing last year? Maybe it was UNLV. No, not UNLV. Georgetown or somebody. But they had a couple of African players on their team. And I mean, those names, I was like, okay, I'm not. And I said it on the radio. I was like, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this because I would mess up these guys' names and I'm not going to do it. So I was calling them by their first names doing the guy. But Brian is amazing. But the only thing I had to correct Brian on is he kept calling my high school Simeon. Mm. Simeon High. I say, bro, it's Simeon. It is not Simeon. Stop. So that might have to be my Brian Barnhart story.
So he teaches you how to say Bashanishvili. You teach him how to say Simeon. You know, it all evens out in the end.
It all works out in the end, baby.
Absolutely.
At any time, is Brian just like, Dion, you can't be this much of a fan of the team?
Oh, so you calling me a homer?
No, I would
You
never.
Have the Illinois flag, the Illinois t-shirt, you know.
This is my basement. I'm supposed to have all of this on here.
I'm not calling you a homer. I'm just – there's some calls that you're just, like, going crazy on. And
I love it.
If I'm, like, an opposing team who's tuning in, I guess I don't know why they would be tuning into the Illinois side of it. But, no, does he ever correct you being like, come on, calm down a little bit?
No, not real. No, actually, he doesn't. And then, you know, I really get on the it's the referees I got to get on. Yeah. I don't get on.
Thank you for
players.
That.
Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Let me say, I've played this game and I've coached this game. I've never seen a good referee. Mm-hmm. I understand their job is hard, but as a player and coach, and I shouldn't say that, they're the Big Ten referees are the best at what they do. You know, and those guys, to see all of that going around and moving and shaking while everything is going, and to be able to catch a ball that went off somebody's fingertip, it's good. But I'm still going to ride the referee. I'm sorry. I'm a coach and I'm a player. I'm going to ride the refs, especially when it's something that I don't agree with. But no, Brian actually likes it, man. I think he kind of feeds it a little bit.
Yeah, the only ref that I can think of that was good was Gene Steratore, the football ref, too. I feel like he was always very consistent. But once we get into the Bo Borowskis and the DJ Carstensons of the world, then we've got some problems.
Now DJ, I like Bo. And I think Bo, is, for the most part, is fair. I mean, if he, you know, for the most, DJ is,
You don't have anything good to say.
Right? Don't say anything. Yeah, careful. Yeah.
Some of those calls, man, I question. But, you know, I like to poke fun at referees. But I do realize that their job is hard. But at the same time, you know, I'm going to call out what I feel might not be the correct call. And I understand basketball has changed. You know, the rules have changed in the Big Ten. You could, you know, back when I was playing, you could hit people. You know, people could come across the lane. You could put a forearm on them. You can't do those things now. And I think that's what kind of bothers me more so than a referee making a call. Because I know they have to make those calls. Like one of the games, I can't remember who we were playing, they called a cylinder foul on one of our players. And I was like, oh, my God, that is the dumbest. That's the dumbest just call ever. I mean, I don't know who – I know who did it, and this is what I told Brian on the radio. I was like, this is a bunch of people that get to sit in a boardroom and make rules that have never played this game before. And I was like, how do you call us? Now, if I'm knocking you off of your post or pushing you, okay, I get it. But just to step up there and play good defense using my body, come on, man.
Yeah.
Can call that crap.
Yeah.
And then spend 15 minutes reviewing a flagrant one and then assessing one additional technical foul that last game.
Yeah, that was a
yes.
Lot. What were you guys talking about during, because it was like a 10-minute break there. What did you two talk about during that whole delay?
Well, really, you know, we were trying to walk through what they were looking at, you know, because Brian, you know, as much as he's around basketball, doesn't know that side. So we were talking about what they were going to look at, what they were going to decide, and I'll say this, in my playing years, my coaching years, they still came back with something that I thought was odd, which was the technical foul and then the free throws. I'm like, again, because I would have, there was not enough there, in my opinion. You called your double text, great, perfectly, let's go, let's play. I didn't think the other kid, and we could see the replay, I didn't think there was much there to spend 15 minutes on. Two, I was ready to get home because the weather was supposed to be bad, so they delayed the game for me. but on the serious side, though, I didn't think there was much there. But we talked about that and what could possibly be the calls that they were making.
The only thing I can think of is they were trying to figure out what they were going to do with all the players, the Penn State players who left the bench, because like they all left the bench.
Right.
They would have had to play with four players, I think, because someone got a double tech and then every single player left the bench. Mm-hmm. So they're just like, do we have to do it, or
let's just spend more time talking about it till they forget about that everyone left the bench is probably what they went through. Yeah. Interesting call.
But yeah. What has been like your favorite game you've got to call as a radio broadcaster?
Favorite game that I've gotten to call. Well, first of all, my favorite was my first live game on BTN when we played Illinois UNLV, and I got to do that game live. So that was a great one. But as far as Illinois basketball radio, it had to be the Illinois win over Michigan State. I mean, it was amazing to watch all of the fans and the Orange Crush and everybody come streaming past me to run out on the floor, and I was a little upset about that too because I wanted to go and I couldn't go because I had to stay on the radio, of course. But that's probably one of the most exciting. And you know, even before that, when watching the year before when Kipper Nichols and Miles Bridges were going at it back and forth that the year prior. I mean, so those were probably the two most exciting games. And you know, I love when we beat Michigan State.
Josh and I were there and stormed the court, and that was a ton of fun. I actually remember while I was storming the court, I was one of the first people to storm, so there were still some security people. So I kind of had to go full extension and shove a little bit of a security guard who was trying to hold me back, not realizing you're about to have like 1,000 more fans come out of this stadium.
If we could just stop this one guy, we've only got
999.
Isn't your spot on the corner there, like next to the bench? So did you get like anyone pushing you?
No one pushed me. so they kind of filed right past us, which was pretty cool. I mean, I was like, damn, I want to go. it couldn't go, but no.
Love it. So something people may not know is on top of being the radio broadcaster, you also work for Illini Athletics and fundraising. I'm curious, what are those phone calls like talking to donors? How do you get donors to pull the trigger to even when the teams on the court may be struggling a bit?
Well, the great thing about it is, and I'm going to be calling you guys too. But the great thing about it is our Illini fans are loyal and they understand that their support is necessary for us to be good and for us to compete on the level that we want to compete. So they get that first and foremost. And a lot of the people that we already talked to, you know, have been in the world of philanthropy. So they understand giving. They understand those things. So you ask when things are down, how is it to make those phone calls? I've been in this position now for a year and a half. So as soon as I took this position, COVID hit. Mm. So try making those phone calls basically when COVID hits. And I've had to learn a lot on one, talking to people not just about the university, but about what's going on in their world, which is something that, you know, I always did anyway. So it really just fit and caring about what they do and how their families are dealing with this situation. So once we get past all of the, I remember when you were playing talk, which normally takes up about the first 15 minutes of the phone call. To be honest, that's one of the things that I had to learn was how to take it away from Deion Thomas, the basketball player, and put this on Deion Thomas, the fundraiser, you know, to kind of guide those conversations. But most people are great. Most people are generous. They're easy to talk to. Of course, that's a wonderful icebreaker to be on the phone with the all-time lead scorer. But most of our fans love our athletes. And once I can get them to understand how their dollars isn't just going into this big pool, but how it really supports the student athletes, whether it's from basketball, football, whatever sport that they prefer, but how it goes directly to help them with their scholarships and student and their student professional, you know, and student development, and their student development, then it usually makes the conversation flow a lot easier. And I basically tell them, if it wasn't for them and their giving, I'm not at the University of Illinois. You know, I am a picture of how your dollars work at the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. There's no way in the world I would have been able to afford to go to Illinois if I had not earned a scholarship. That scholarship is paid for by the donors directly. We don't get money from the university to support the athletic department. That is all, you know, we're on our own. Mm-hmm. So we have to raise every dollar to cover every scholarship for every single 500 plus student athletes, you know, to cover what they do.
You're pretty good at this. You know, you've only been at this, you said, a year and a half. I don't know. That's a pretty good sales pitch. You know, I know we're just a couple of recent grads here, but I don't know.
I can also empathize with those guys who spend 15 minutes talking to you about your career, because I know 20, 30 years from now, if you got Io on the phone with us, I think we would all be fangirling quite a bit.
Yes.
Like, so remember that time against Michigan?
Yeah, that phone bill is not going to pay for the donation.
No.
Well, I'll tell you this. Now, the misconception, and this is one of the biggest things that I had to get people to understand. Everyone sees, you know, and it's all publicized, when you see someone give a $500,000 gift or a $5 million gift, everybody thinks that this is the giving. And I'm like, no, we have people that are giving $50. And I mean, and that $50 is a $50 for the year, not a $50, you know, every month thing. And we have people that are giving, you know, like I said, $5, $10 million. That's where the biggest thing is getting everybody to understand that every little bit counts,
sure.
You know, and every little bit goes towards, you know, helping these young people do what they do. You know, from next week on we do a thing that's called the Basketball Stadium Club. Mm. And we bring on normally a guest speaker and I have a couple of guests, and they're normally done before the games come on, pregame. This is where I love when the coaches come on. It's like, I'm having the wrestling coach on our next one. They don't get money, you know, but yet we have to, you know, they don't have scholarships and these sort, but we have to fundraise for it. They're not bringing in revenue. No one wants to sit and watch wrestling for the most part on television, except for people that like real wrestling, not WWE or that kind of stuff. But they don't get that. So it's really great to be able to show people the other side of what it is that they do and how they help people. You're not just helping people that look like me or that come from where I come from. You're helping these guys live out their dreams as well, you know, of competing on the college level. So yeah, I'm gonna call you guys. That $50 works, bro.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we won't be quite in the 10 millions here. Just want to level set that ahead of
yes,
time.
Yes, yes.
Well, not yet.
Right.
That's the angle.
Depends how many people listen to this episode, but will depend on how many millions we can give. Absolutely.
Long-term investment. Awesome. All right. Before we let you go, we heard you were writing an autobiography, so wanted to ask, any untold stories we can get a little teaser or hint of that might end up in there that a lot of people don't know about?
Well, I have several things that I'm going to do, and the one autobiography is, yes, you'll hear about some things in my young life, and this is why mentors are important. This is why people coming into your life at the right times are important, because Deion was, and I'm a nice guy, I am, really, but I was doing some dumb shit that could have really have changed the trajectory of my life. If it wasn't for my stepfather, who was a Chicago police officer for 44 years before his passing last couple of weeks ago. And he came in at the right time and kind of steered me the other way. And then Bob Hamburg and basketball came in, and it steered me even further away from doing some of the dumb things that I was doing in Inglewood. So those stories would be in there. And no one knows those stories. So you just got a peek.
Yeah.
Because my mom always told me, if you're going to do bad stuff, you do it by yourself so nobody can tell on you.
I love it. Well, I'm excited to read it and hear about it. But thank you so much, Deion, for taking the time out of your schedule to chat with us. This was absolutely awesome.
Good.
Really good time. But thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Boardroom. We'll catch you on the next one. ILL.
Bye and I.